He was later found wandering in the woods near the train tracks, captured and brought back to the facility. A few months earlier, Rufus had tried to break a window at the World Trade Center to jump off the building. He had been diagnosed with schizophrenia. To Watson, a firm believer in the genetic basis for the disease, the Human Genome Project had come home, literally. There were no animal models for schizophrenia, nor any obviously linked polymorphisms that would allow geneticists to find the relevant genes. The only way to give Rufus a life was to understand why he was sick, and the only way we could do that was to get the genome. But which genome to get? Some scientists, including Sulston, advocated a graded approach, starting with simple organisms such as baker's yeast, the worm, or the fly, and then scaling the ladder of complexity and size to the human genome. Others, such as Watson, wanted to leap directly into the human genome. After a prolonged internal debate, the scientists reached a compromise. The sequencing of the genomes of simple organisms, such as worms and flies, would begin at first. These projects would carry the names of their respective organisms, the Worm Genome Project or the Fruit Fly Genome Project, and they would fine-tune the technology of gene sequencing. The sequencing of human genes would continue in parallel. The lessons learned from simple genomes would be applied to the much larger and more complex human genome. This larger endeavor, the comprehensive sequencing of the entire human genome, was termed the Human Genome Project. The NIH and DOE, meanwhile, jostled to control the Human Genome Project. By 1989, after several congressional hearings, a second compromise was reached. The National Institutes of Health would act as the official lead agency of the project, with the DOE contributing resources and strategic management. Watson was chosen as its head. International collaborators were swiftly added. The Medical Research Council of the United Kingdom and the Wellcome Trust joined the effort. In time, French, Japanese, Chinese, and German scientists would join the Genome Project. In January 1989, a 12-member council of advisors met in a conference room in Building 31 on the far corner of the NIH campus in Bethesda. The council was chaired by Norton Zinder, the geneticist who had helped draft the Asilomar moratorium. "Today we begin," Zinder announced. "We are initiating an unending study of human biology. Whatever it's going to be, it will be an adventure, a priceless endeavor, and when it's done, someone else will sit down and say, it's time to begin." On January 28, 1983, on the eve of the launch of the Human Genome Project, Carrie Buck died in a nursing home in Waynesboro, Pennsylvania. She was 76 years old. Her birth and death had bookended the near century of the gene. Her generation had borne witness to the scientific resurrection of genetics, its forceful entry into public discourse, its perversion into social engineering and eugenics, its post-war emergence as the central theme of the new biology, its impact on human physiology and pathology, its powerful explanatory power in our understanding of illness, and its inevitable intersection with questions of fate, identity, and choice. She had been one of the earliest victims of the misunderstandings of a powerful new science, and she had watched that science transform our understanding of medicine, culture, and society. What of her genetic imbecility? In 1930, 3 years after her Supreme Court mandated sterilization, Carrie Buck was released from the Virginia State Colony and sent to work with a family in Bland County, Virginia. Carrie Buck's only daughter, Vivian Dobbs, the child who had been examined by a court and declared imbecile, died of enterocolitis in 1932. During the 8-odd years of her life, Vivian had performed reasonably well in school. In grade 1B, for instance, she received A's and B's in deportment and spelling, and a C in mathematics, a subject that she had always struggled with. In April 1931, she was placed on the honor roll. What remains of the school report card suggests a cheery, pleasant, happy-go-lucky child, whose performance was no better and no worse than that of any other school child. Nothing in Vivian's story bears an even remote suggestion of an inherited propensity for mental illness or imbecility, the diagnosis that had sealed Carrie Buck's fate in court. The geographers. So geographers and Afric maps with savage pictures fill their gaps, and o'er uninhabitable downs place elephants for want of towns. Jonathan Swift on poetry. More and more, the Human Genome Project, supposedly one of mankind's noblest undertakings, is resembling a mud wrestling match. Justin Gillis, 2000. It is fair to say that the first surprise for the Human Genome Project had nothing to do with genes. In 1989, as Watson, Zinder, and their colleagues were gearing up to launch the Genome Project, a little-known neurobiologist at NIH, Craig Venter, proposed a shortcut to genome sequencing. Pugnacious, single-minded, and belligerent, a reluctant student with middling grades, a surfing and sailing addict, and a former serviceman in the Vietnam War, Venter had an ability to lunge headlong into unknown projects. He had trained in neurobiology and had spent much of his scientific life studying adrenaline. In the mid-80s, working at the NIH, Venter had become interested in sequencing genes expressed in the human brain. In 1986, he had heard of Leroy Hood's rapid sequencing machine and rushed to buy an early version for his laboratory. When it arrived, he called it, "My future in a crate." He had an engineer's tinkering hands and a biochemist's love of mixing solutions. Within months, Venter had become an expert in rapid genome sequencing using the semi-automated sequencer. Venter's strategy for genome sequencing relied on a radical simplification. While the human genome contains genes, of course, the vast part of the genome is devoid of genes. The enormous stretches of DNA between genes, called intergenic DNA, are somewhat akin to the long highways between Canadian towns. And as Phil Sharp and Richard Roberts had demonstrated, a gene is itself broken up into segments, with long spacers called introns interposed between the protein-coding segments. Intergenic DNA and introns, spacers between genes and stuffers within genes, do not encode any protein information. Some of these stretches contain information to regulate and coordinate the expression of genes in time and space. They encode on and off switches appended to genes. Other stretches encode no known function. The structure of the human genome can thus be likened to a sentence that reads, "This, dot, dot, is the, dot, dot, struck, dot, dot, sure, dot, dot, comma, comma, dot, dot, of, dot, your, dot, parentheses, dot, gene, dot, dot, ohm, dot, dot, close parentheses, dot, dot, dot." Where the words correspond to the genes, the ellipses correspond to the spacers and stuffers, and the occasional punctuation marks demarcate the regulatory sequences of genes. Venter's first shortcut was to ignore the spacers and stuffers of the human genome. Introns and intergenic DNA did not carry protein information, he reasoned, so why not focus on the active protein-encoding parts? And, piling shortcut on shortcut, he proposed that perhaps even these active parts could be assessed even faster if only fragments of genes were sequenced. Convinced that this fragmented gene approach would work, Venter had begun to sequence hundreds of such gene fragments from brain tissue. To continue our analogy between genomes and sentences in English, it was as if Venter had decided to find shards of words in a sentence, struck, your, and geno, in the human genome. He might not learn the content of the entire sentence with this method, he knew, but perhaps he could deduce enough from the shards to understand the crucial elements of human genes. Watson was appalled. Venter's gene fragment strategy was indubitably faster and cheaper, but to many geneticists, it was also sloppy and incomplete, since it produced only fragmentary information about the genome. The conflict was deepened by an unusual development. In the summer of 1991, as Venter's group began to drudge up sequences of human gene fragments from the brain, the NIH Technology Transfer Office contacted Venter about patenting the novel gene fragments. For Watson, the dissonance was embarrassing. Now it seemed one arm of the NIH was filing for exclusive rights to the same information that another arm was trying to discover and make freely available. But by what logic could genes, or in Venter's case, active fragments of genes, be patented? At Stanford, Boyer and Cohen, recall, had patented a method to recombine pieces of DNA to create genetic chimeras. Genentech had patented a process to express proteins such as insulin in bacteria. In 1984, Amgen had filed a patent for the isolation of the blood production hormone erythropoietin using recombinant DNA. But even that patent, carefully read, involved a scheme for the production and isolation of a distinct protein with a distinct function. no one had ever patented a gene or a piece of genetic information for its own sake. Was a human gene not like any other body part, a nose or the left arm, and therefore fundamentally unpatentable? Or was the discovery of new genetic information so novel that it would merit ownership and patentability? Sulston, for one, was firmly opposed to the idea of gene patents. "Patents, or so I had believed, are designed to protect inventions," he wrote. "There was no invention involved in finding gene fragments, so how could they be patentable?" "It's a quick and dirty land grab," one researcher wrote dismissively. The controversy around Venter's gene patents reached an even more fervent pitch because the gene fragments were being sequenced at random, without the ascription of any function to most of the genes. Since Venter's approach often resulted in incomplete shards of genes being sequenced, the nature of the information was necessarily garbled. At times, the shards were long enough to deduce the function of a gene, but more commonly, no real understanding could be ascribed to these fragments. Could you patent an elephant by describing its tail? What about patenting an elephant by describing three discontinuous parts of its tail, Eric Lander argued. At a congressional hearing on the genome project, Watson erupted with vehemence. Virtually any monkey could generate such fragments, he argued. Walter Bodmer, the English geneticist, warned that if the Americans granted gene fragment patents to Venter, the British would start their own rival patenting effort. Within weeks, the genome would be balkanized, carved up into 1,000 territorial colonies carrying American, British, and German flags. On June 10, 1992, fed up with the interminable squabbles, Venter left the NIH to launch his own private gene sequencing institute. At first, the organization was called Institute for Genome Research, but Venter cannily spotted the flaw in the name. Its acronym, IGOR, carried the unfortunate association with a cross-eyed Gothic butler apprenticed to Frankenstein. Venter changed it to THE Institute for Genomic Research, or TIGER for short. On paper, or at least on scientific papers, TIGER was a phenomenal success. Venter collaborated with scientific luminaries such as Bert Vogelstein and Ken Kinsler to discover new genes associated with cancer. More important, Venter kept battering at the technological frontiers of genome sequencing. Uniquely sensitive to his critics, he was also uniquely responsive to them. In 1993, he expanded his sequencing efforts beyond gene fragments to full genes and to genomes. Working with a new ally, Hamilton Smith, the Nobel Prize-winning bacteriologist, Venter decided that he would sequence the entire genome of a bacterium that causes lethal human pneumonias, Haemophilus influenza. Venter's strategy was an expansion of the gene fragment approach he had used with the brain, except with an important twist. This time, he would shatter the bacterial genome into a million pieces using a shotgun-like device. He would then sequence hundreds of thousands of fragments at random, then use their overlapping segments to assemble them to solve the entire genome. To return to our sentence analogy, imagine trying to assemble a word using the following word fragments: stra, uctu, uctur, structu, and uctur. A computer can use the overlapping segments to assemble the full word, structure. The solution depends on the presence of the overlapping sequences. If an overlap does not exist or some part of the word gets omitted, it becomes impossible to assemble the correct word. But Venter was confident that he could use this approach to shatter and reassemble most of the genome. It was a Humpty Dumpty strategy. All the king's men would solve the jigsaw puzzle by fitting the parts together again. The technique, called shotgun sequencing, had been used by Fred Sanger, the inventor of gene sequencing, in the 1980s. But Venter's attack on the Haemophilus genome was the most ambitious application of this method in its history. Venter and Smith launched the Haemophilus project in the winter of 1993. By July 1995, it was complete. "The final paper took 40 drafts," Venter later wrote. "We knew this paper was going to be historic, and I was insistent that it be as near perfect as possible." It was a marvel. The Stanford geneticist Lucy Shapiro wrote about how members of her lab had stayed up all night reading the H. flu genome, thrilled by the first glimpse at the complete gene content of a living species. There were genes to generate energy, genes to make coat proteins, genes to manufacture proteins, to regulate food, to evade the immune system. Sanger himself wrote to Venter to describe the work as magnificent. While Venter was sequencing bacterial genomes at TIGER, the Human Genome Project was undergoing drastic internal changes. In 1993, after a series of quarrels with the head of the NIH, Watson stepped down as the project's director. He was swiftly replaced by Francis Collins, the Michigan geneticist known for cloning the cystic fibrosis gene in 1989. If the Genome Project had not found Collins in 1993, it might have found it necessary to invent him. He was almost preternaturally matched to its peculiar challenges. A devout Christian from Virginia, an able communicator and administrator, a first-rate scientist, Collins was measured, cautious, and diplomatic. To Venter's furious little yacht constantly tilting against the winds, Collins was a transoceanic liner, barely registering the tumult around him. By 1995, as Tiger had roared forward with the Haemophilus genome, the Genome Project had concentrated its efforts on refining the basic technologies for gene sequencing. In contrast to Tiger's strategy, which was to shred the genome to pieces, sequence at random, and reassemble the data post hoc, the Genome Project had chosen a more orderly approach, assembling and organizing the genomic fragments into a physical map, who is next to whom, confirming the identity and the overlaps of the clones, and then sequencing the clones in order. To Lander, Collins, and Sulston, this clone-by-clone assembly was the only strategy that made any sense. A mathematician-turned-biologist-turned-gene sequencer, Lander, whose opposition to shotgun sequencing could almost be described as an aesthetic revulsion, liked the idea of sequencing the complete genome piece by piece, as if solving an algebra problem. Venter's strategy, he worried, would inevitably leave potholes in the genome. What if you took a word, broke it apart, and tried to reconstruct it from the parts? Lander asked. That might work if you can find every piece of the word, or if every fragment overlaps, but what if some letters of the word are missing? The word you might construct out of the available alphabets might convey precisely the opposite meaning to the real word. What if you found just the letters P-U-N-Y in profundity? Lander also feared the false intoxication of a half-finished genome. If gene sequencers left 10% of the genome incomplete, the full sequence would never be completed. The real challenge of the Human Genome Project wasn't starting the sequence, it was finishing the sequence of the genome. If you left holes in the genome but gave yourself the impression of completion, then no one would have the patience to finish the full sequence. Scientists would clap, dust their hands, pat their backs, and move on. The draft would always remain a draft. The clone-by-clone approach required more money, deeper investments in infrastructure, and the one factor that seemed to have gone missing among genome researchers, patience. At MIT, Lander had assembled a formidable team of young scientists, mathematicians, chemists, engineers, and a group of caffeinated 20-something computer hackers, who were developing algorithms to plod their way methodically through the genome. Lander was not working alone. The British team, funded by the Wellcome Trust, was developing its own platforms for analysis and assembly. In May 1998, the ever-moving Venter tacked sharply windward yet again. Although Tiger's shotgun sequencing efforts had been undeniably successful, Venter still chafed under the organizational structure of the Institute. Tiger had been set up as a strange hybrid, a non-profit institute nestled inside a for-profit company called Human Genome Sciences, HGS. Venter found this Russian doll organizational system ridiculous. He argued relentlessly with his bosses. Venter decided to sever his ties with Tiger. He formed yet another new company which would focus entirely on human genome sequencing. Venter called the new company Celera, a contraction of Accelerate. A week before a pivotal Human Genome Project meeting at Cold Spring Harbor, Venter met Collins between flights at the red carpet lounge at Dulles Airport. Celera was about to launch an unprecedented push to sequence the human genome using shotgun sequencing, Venter announced matter-of-factly. It had bought 200 of the most sophisticated sequencing machines and was prepared to run them to the ground to finish the sequence in record time. Venter agreed to make much of the information available as a public resource, but with a menacing clause. Celera would seek to patent the 300 most important genes that might act as targets for drugs for diseases such as breast cancer, schizophrenia, and diabetes. He laid out an ambitious timeline. Celera hoped to have the whole human genome assembled by 2001, beating the projected deadline for the publicly funded Human Genome Project by 4 years. He got up abruptly and caught the next flight to California. Stung into action, Collins and Lander rapidly reorganized the public effort. They threw open the sluices of federal funding, sending $60 million in sequencing grants to seven American centers. Maynard Olson, a yeast geneticist from Berkeley, and Robert Waterston, a former worm biologist and now a gene sequencing expert from Washington University, provided key strategic advice. Losing the genome to a private company would be a monumental embarrassment for the Genome Project. As knowledge of the looming public-private rivalry spread, newspapers were awash with speculation. On May 12, 1998, the Washington Post announced, "Private firm aims to beat government to gene map." In December 1998, the Worm Genome Project scored a decisive victory. From the gene sequencing facility in Hingston near Cambridge, England, John Sulston brought news that the worm, C. elegans, genome had been completely sequenced using the clone-by-clone approach favored by proponents of the Human Genome Project. If the Haemophilus genome had nearly brought geneticists to their knees with amazement and wonder in 1995, then the worm genome, the first complete sequence of a multicellular organism, demanded a full-fledged genuflection. Worms are vastly more complex than Haemophilus and vastly more similar to humans. They have mouths, guts, muscles, a nervous system, and even a rudimentary brain. They touch, they feel, they move, they turn their heads away from noxious stimuli, they socialize. Perhaps they register something akin to worm anxiety when their food runs out. Perhaps they feel a fleeting pulse of joy when they mate. C. elegans was found to have 18,891 genes. 36% of the encoded proteins were similar to proteins found in humans. The rest, about 10,000, had no known similarities to known human genes. These 10,000 genes were either unique to worms or, much more likely, a potent reminder of how little humans knew of human genes. Many of these genes would indeed later be found to have human counterparts. Notably, only 10% of the encoded genes were similar to genes found in bacteria. 90% of the nematode genome was dedicated to the unique complexities of organism building, demonstrating, yet again, the fierce starburst of evolutionary innovation that had forged multicellular creatures out of single-celled ancestors several million years ago. As was the case with human genes, a single worm gene could have multiple functions. A gene called CEH13, for instance, organizes the location of cells in the developing nervous system, allows the cells to migrate to the anterior parts of the worm's anatomy, and ensures that the vulva of the worm is appropriately created. And conversely, a single function might be specified by multiple genes. The creation of a mouth in worms requires the coordinated function of multiple genes. The discovery of 10,000 new proteins with more than 10,000 new functions would have amply justified the novelty of the project. Yet the most surprising feature of the worm genome was not protein-encoding genes, but the number of genes that made RNA messages, but no protein. These genes, called non-coding because they do not encode proteins, were scattered through the genome, but they clustered on certain chromosomes. There were hundreds of them, perhaps thousands. Some non-coding genes were of known function. The ribosome, the giant intracellular machine that makes proteins, contains specialized RNA molecules that assist in the manufacture of proteins. Other non-coding genes were eventually found to encode small RNAs called microRNAs, which regulate genes with incredible specificity. But many of these genes were mysterious and ill-defined. They were not dark matter, but shadow matter of the genome visible to geneticists, yet unknown in function or significance. What is a gene, then? When Mendel discovered the gene in 1865, he knew it only as an abstract phenomenon, a discrete determinant transmitted intact across generations that specified a single visible property or phenotype, such as flower color or seed texture in peas. Morgan and Muller deepened this understanding by demonstrating that genes were physical, material, structures carried on chromosomes. Avery advanced this understanding of genes by identifying the chemical form of that material. Genetic information was carried in DNA. Watson, Crick, Wilkins, and Franklin solved its molecular structure as a double helix with two paired complementary strands. In the 1930s, Beadle and Tatum solved the mechanism of gene action by discovering that a gene worked by specifying the structure of a protein. Brenner and Jacob identified a messenger intermediate, an RNA copy, that is required for the translation of genetic information into a protein. Monod and Jacob added to the dynamic conception of genes by demonstrating that genes can be turned on and off by increasing or decreasing this RNA message, using regulatory switches appended to each gene. The comprehensive sequencing of the worm genome extended and modified these insights on the concept of a gene. A gene specifies a function in an organism, yes, but a single gene can specify more than a single function. A gene need not provide instructions to build a protein. It can be used to encode RNA alone and no proteins. It need not be a contiguous piece of DNA. It can be split into parts. It has regulatory sequences appended to it, but these sequences need not be immediately adjacent to a gene. Already, comprehensive genome sequencing had opened the door to an unexplored universe in organismal biology. Like an infinitely recursive encyclopedia, whose entry under encyclopedia has to be updated constantly, the sequencing of a genome had shifted our conception of genes, and therefore, of the genome itself. The C. elegans genome, published to universal scientific acclaim in a special issue of Science magazine, with a picture of the sub-centimeter nematode emblazoned on its cover in December 1998, was a powerful vindication for the Human Genome Project. Days after the worm genome announcement, Lander had exciting news of his own. The Human Genome Project had completed one quarter of the sequence of the human genome. In a dark, dry, vault-like warehouse on an industrial lot near Kendall Square in Cambridge, Massachusetts, 125 semi-automated sequencing machines, shaped like enormous gray boxes, were reading about 200 DNA letters every second. Sanger's virus, which had taken him 3 years to sequence, would have been completed in 25 seconds. The sequence of an entire human chromosome, chromosome 22, had been fully assembled and was awaiting final confirmation. In about a month, the project would cross a memorable sequencing landmark, its 1 billionth human base pair, a GC, as it turned out, of the total 3 billion. Celera, meanwhile, had no intention of lagging behind in this arms race. Flush with funds from private investors, it had doubled its output of gene sequences. On September 17, 1999, barely 9 months after the publication of the worm genome, Celera opened a vast genome conference at the Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami with its own strategic counterpunch. It had sequenced the genome of the fruit fly, Drosophila melanogaster. Working with the fruit fly geneticist Jerry Rubin and a team of geneticists from Berkeley in Europe, Venter's team had assembled the fly genome in a record spurt of 11 months, faster than any prior gene sequencing project. As Venter, Rubin, and Mark Adams rose to the podium to give talks, the leap of the advance became clear. In the 9 decades since Thomas Morgan had begun his work on fruit flies, geneticists had identified about 2,500 genes. Celera's draft sequence contained all 2,500 known genes and, in a single swoop, had added 10,500 new ones. In the hushed, reverential minute that followed the end of the presentations, Venter did not hesitate to drive a switchblade through his competitor's spines. Oh, and by the way, we have just started sequencing human DNA, and it looks as if the technical hurdles are going to be less of a problem than they had been with the fly. In March 2000, science published the sequence of the fruit fly genome in yet another special issue of the journal, this time with a 1934 engraving of a male and female fruit fly on its cover. Even the most strident critics of shotgun sequencing were sobered by the quality and depth of the data. Celera's shotgun strategy had left some important gaps in the sequence, but significant sections of the fly genome were complete. Comparisons between human, worm, and fly genes revealed several provocative patterns. Of the 289 human genes known to be involved with a disease, 177 genes, more than 60%, had a related counterpart in the fly. There were no genes for sickle cell anemia or hemophilia. Flies do not have red blood cells or form clots, but genes involved in colon cancer, breast cancer, Tay-Sachs disease, muscular dystrophy, cystic fibrosis, Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, and diabetes, or close counterparts of those genes, were present. Although separated by 4 legs, 2 wings, and several million years of evolution, flies and humans shared core pathways and genetic networks. As William Blake had suggested in 1794, the diminutive fly had turned out to be a man like me. The most bewildering feature of the fly genome was also a matter of size, or more accurately, it was the proverbial revelation that size does not matter. Contrary to the expectations of even the most seasoned fly biologists, the fly was found to have just 13,601 genes, 5,000 fewer genes than a worm. Less had been used to build more. Out of just 13,000 genes was created an organism that mates, grows old, gets drunk, gives birth, experiences pain, has smell, sight, taste, and touch, and shares our insatiable desire for ripe summer fruit. The lesson is that the complexity apparent in flies is not achieved by the sheer number of genes, Rubin said. The human genome is likely to be an amplified version of a fly genome. The evolution of additional complex attributes is essentially an organizational one, a matter of novel interactions that derive from the temporal and spatial segregation of fairly similar components. As Richard Dawkins puts it, all animals probably have a relatively similar repertoire of proteins that need to be called forth at any particular time. The difference between a more complex organism and a simpler one, between a human and a nematode worm, is not that the humans have more of those fundamental pieces of apparatus, but that they can call them into action in more complicated sequences and in a more complicated range of spaces. It was not the size of the ship, yet again, but the way the planks were configured. The fly genome was its own Delphic boat. In May 2000, with Celera and the Human Genome Project sprinting neck and neck toward a draft sequence of the human genome, Venter received a phone call from his friend Ari Petrinos from the Department of Energy. Petrinos had contacted Francis Collins and asked him to stop by Petrinos' townhouse for an evening drink. Would Venter consider joining? There would be no aides, advisors, or journalists, no entourage of investors or funders. The conversation would be entirely private, and the conclusions would remain strictly confidential. Petrinos' phone call to Venter had been orchestrated for several weeks. News of the arms race between Celera and the Human Genome Project had filtered through political channels and reached the White House. President Clinton, with his unfailing nose for public relations, realized that news of the contest would escalate into an embarrassment for the government, especially if Celera was the first to announce victory. Clinton had sent his aides a note with a terse two-word dictum, "Fix this," appended to the margin. Petrinos was the appointed fixer. A week later, Venter and Collins met in the rec room in the basement of Petrinos' townhouse in Georgetown. The atmosphere was understandably chilly. Petrinos waited for the mood to thaw, then delicately broached the subject of the meeting. Would Collins and Venter consider a joint announcement of the sequencing of the human genome? Both Venter and Collins had come mentally prepared for such an offer. Collins had already agreed to a joint revelation. In part, he had instigated the meeting with Venter, using Petrinos as an intermediary. Venter mulled over the possibility and acquiesced, but with several caveats. He agreed to a joint ceremony at the White House to celebrate the draft sequence and back-to-back publications in Science. He made no commitments about timelines. This, as one journalist would later describe it, was the most carefully scripted draw. That initial meeting in Ari Petrinos' basement room became the first of several private meetings between Venter, Collins, and Petrinos. Over the next 3 weeks, Collins and Venter warily choreographed the general outline of the announcement. President Clinton would open the event, followed by Tony Blair and by talks from Collins and Venter. In effect, Celera and the Human Genome Project would be declared joint victors in the race to sequence the human genome. The White House was swiftly informed of the possibility of the announcement and acted quickly to secure a date. Venter and Collins returned to their respective groups and agreed on June 26, 2000. At 10:19 a.m. on the morning of June 26, Venter, Collins, and the President gathered at the White House to reveal the first survey of the human genome to a large group of scientists, journalists, and foreign dignitaries. In truth, neither Celera nor the Genome Project had completed their sequences, but both groups had decided to continue with the announcement as a symbolic gesture, even as the White House was unveiling the supposed first survey of the genome. Scientists at Celera and the Genome Project were keying frantically at their terminals, trying to string the sequence together into a meaningful whole. Tony Blair joined the meeting from London by satellite. Norton Zinder, Richard Roberts, Eric Lander, and Ham Smith sat in the audience, joined by James Watson in a crisp white suit. Clinton spoke first, comparing the map of the human genome to the Lewis and Clark map of the continent. Nearly two centuries ago, in this room, on this floor, Thomas Jefferson and a trusted aide spread out a magnificent map, a map Jefferson had long prayed he would get to see in his lifetime. It was a map that defined the contours and forever expanded the frontiers of our continent and our imagination. Today the world is joining us here in the East Room to behold the map of even greater significance. We are here to celebrate the completion of the first survey of the entire human genome. Without a doubt, this is the most important, most wondrous map ever produced by humankind. Venter, the last to speak, could not resist reminding his audience that this map had also been achieved in parallel by a private expedition led by a private explorer. At 12:30 today, at a joint press conference with the public genome effort, Celera Genomics will describe the first assembly of the human genetic code from whole genome shotgun method. The method used by Celera has determined the genetic code of five individuals. We have sequenced the genome of three females and two males who have identified themselves as Hispanic, Asian, Caucasian, or African-American. Like so many truces, the fragile armistice between Venter and Collins barely outlived its torturous birth. In part, the conflict centered on old quarrels. Although the status of its gene patents was still uncertain, Celera had decided to monetize its sequencing project by selling subscriptions to its database to academic researchers and pharmaceutical companies. Big pharma companies, Venter had astutely reasoned, might want to know gene sequences to discover new drugs, especially ones that target particular proteins. But Venter also wanted to publish Celera's human genome sequence in a major scientific journal, Science, for example, which required the company to deposit its gene sequences in a public repository. The scientist cannot publish a scientific paper for the general public while insisting that its essential data is secret. Justifiably, Watson, Lander, and Collins were bitingly critical of Celera's attempt to straddle the commercial and academic worlds. "My greatest success," Venter told an interviewer, "was I managed to get hated by both worlds." The Genome Project, meanwhile, was struggling with technical hurdles. Having sequenced vast parts of the human genome using the clone-by-clone approach, the project was now poised at a critical juncture. It had to assemble the pieces to complete the puzzle. But that task, seemingly modest on a theoretical level, represented a daunting computational problem. Substantial portions of the sequence were still missing. Not every part of the genome was amenable to cloning and sequencing, and assembling non-overlapping segments was vastly more complicated than had been anticipated, like solving a puzzle containing pieces that had fallen into the cracks of furniture. Lander recruited yet another team of scientists to help him. David Hausler, a computer scientist at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and his 40-year-old protege, James Kent, a former programmer-turned-molecular biologist. In a fit of inspired frenzy, Hausler convinced the university to buy 100 desktop PCs so that Kent could write and run tens of thousands of lines of code in parallel, icing his wrists at night so that he could start coding every morning. At Celera II, the genome assembly problem was proving to be frustrating. Parts of the human genome are full of strange, repetitive sequences, equivalent to a big stretch of blue sky in a jigsaw puzzle, as Venter described it. Computational scientists in charge of assembling the genome worked week upon week to put the gene fragments in order, but the complete sequence was still missing. By the winter of 2000, both projects neared completion, but the communications between the groups, strained at its best moments, had fallen apart. Venter accused the Genome Project of a vendetta against Celera. Lander wrote to the editors of Science protesting Celera's strategy of selling the sequence database to subscribers and restricting parts of it to the public, while trying to publish yet other selected parts of the data in a journal. Celera was trying to have its genome and sell it too. In the history of scientific writing since the 1600s, Lander complained, the disclosure of data has been linked to the announcement of a discovery. That's the basis of modern science. In pre-modern times, you could say, I found an answer, I've made lead into gold, proclaim the discovery, and then refuse to show the results. But the whole point of professional scientific journals is disclosure and credit. Worse, Collins and Lander accused Celera of using the Human Genome Project's published sequence as a scaffold to assemble its own genome. Molecular plagiarism. Bencher retorted that the idea was ludicrous. Solera had deciphered all the other genomes with no help from such scaffolds. Left to its own devices, Lander announced, Solera's data was nothing more than a genome-tossed salad. As Solera edged toward the final draft of its paper, scientists made frantic appeals for the company to deposit its results in the publicly available repository of sequences, named GenBank. Ultimately, Venter agreed to provide free access to academic researchers, but with several important constraints. Dissatisfied with the compromise, Sulston, Lander, and Collins chose to send their paper to a rival journal, Nature. On February 15th and 16th, 2001, the Human Genome Project Consortium and Solera published their papers in Nature and Science, respectively. Both were enormous studies, nearly spanning the lengths of the two journals. At 66,000 words, the Human Genome Project paper was the largest study published in Nature's history. Every great scientific paper is a conversation with its own history, and the opening paragraphs of the Nature paper were written with full cognizance of its moment of reckoning. The rediscovery of Mendel's laws of heredity in the opening weeks of the 20th century sparked a scientific quest to understand the nature and content of genetic information that has propelled biology for the last 100 years. The scientific progress made since that time falls naturally into four main phases, corresponding roughly to the four quarters of the century. The first established the cellular basis of heredity, the chromosomes. The second defined the molecular basis of heredity, the DNA double helix. The third unlocked the informational basis of heredity, that is, the genetic code, with the discovery of the biological mechanism by which cells read the information contained in genes, and with the invention of the recombinant DNA technologies of cloning and sequencing by which scientists can do the same. The sequence of the human genome, the project asserted, marked the starting point of the fourth phase of genetics. This was the era of genomics, the assessment of the entire genomes of organisms, including humans. There is an old conundrum in philosophy that asks, if an intelligent machine can ever decipher its own instruction manual, for humans, the manual was now complete. Deciphering it, reading it, and understanding it would be quite another matter. The Book of Man in 23 volumes. 1. Is man no more than this? Consider him well. William Shakespeare, King Lear, Act 3, Scene 4. 2. There are mountains beyond mountains. Haitian proverb. 3. It has 3,088,286,401 letters of DNA, give or take a few. 4. Published as a book with a standard size font, it would contain just 4 letters. A, G, C, T, T, G, C, A, G, 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 and so on, stretching inscrutably page upon page for over 1.5 million pages, 66 times the size of the Encyclopedia Britannica. 5. It is divided into 23 pairs of chromosomes, 46 in all, in most cells in the body. All other apes, including gorillas, chimpanzees, and orangutans have 24 pairs. At some point in hominid evolution, 2 medium-sized chromosomes in some ancestral ape fused to form 1. The human genome departed cordially from the ape genome several million years ago, acquiring new mutations and variations over time. We lost a chromosome, but gained a thumb. 6. It encodes about 20,687 genes in total. Only 1,796 more than worms, 12,000 fewer than corn, and 25,000 fewer genes than rice or wheat. The difference between human and breakfast cereal is not a matter of gene numbers, but of the sophistication of gene networks. It is not what we have, it is how we use it. 7. It is fiercely inventive. It squeezes complexity out of simplicity. It orchestrates the activation or repression of certain genes in only certain cells and at certain times, creating unique contexts and partners for each gene in time and space, and thus produces near infinite functional variation out of its limited repertoire. and it mixes and matches gene modules, called exons, within single genes to extract even further combinatorial diversity out of its gene repertoire. These two strategies, gene regulation and gene splicing, appear to be used more extensively in the human genome than in the genomes of most organisms. More than the enormity of gene numbers, the diversity of gene types, or the originality of gene function, it is the ingenuity of our genome that is the secret to our complexity. 8. It is dynamic. In some cells, it reshuffles its own sequence to make novel variants of itself. Cells of the immune system secrete antibodies, missile-like proteins designed to attach themselves to invading pathogens. But since pathogens are constantly evolving, antibodies must also be capable of changing. An evolving pathogen demands an evolving host. The genome accomplishes this counter-revolution by reshuffling its genetic elements, thereby achieving astounding diversity. S.T.ER and G.N.Om can be reshuffled to form an entirely new word, C.O.M.E.T. The reshuffled genes generate the diversity of antibodies. In these cells, every genome is capable of giving rise to an entirely different genome. 9. Parts of it are surprisingly beautiful. On a vast stretch on chromosome 11, for instance, there is a causeway dedicated entirely to the sensation of smell. Here, a cluster of 155 closely related genes encodes a series of protein receptors that are professional smell sensors. Each receptor binds to a unique chemical structure, like a key to a lock, and generates a distinctive sensation of smell in the brain. Spearmint, lemon, caraway, jasmine, vanilla, ginger, pepper. An elaborate form of gene regulation ensures that only one odor receptor gene is chosen from this cluster and expressed in a single smell-sensing neuron in the nose, thereby enabling us to discriminate thousands of smells. 10. Genes, oddly, comprise only a minuscule fraction of it. An enormous proportion, a bewildering 98%, is not dedicated to genes per se, but to enormous stretches of DNA that are interspersed between genes, intergenic DNA, or within genes, introns. These long stretches encode no RNA and no protein. They exist in the genome either because they regulate gene expression or for reasons that we do not yet understand or because of no reason whatsoever. That is, they are junk DNA. If the genome were a line stretching across the Atlantic Ocean between North America and Europe, genes would be occasional specks of land strewn across long, dark tracts of water. Laid end to end, these specks would be no longer than the largest Galapagos island or a train line across the city of Tokyo. 11. It is encrusted with history. Embedded within it are peculiar fragments of DNA, some derived from ancient viruses that were inserted into the genome in the distant past and have been carried passively for millennia since then. Some of these fragments were once capable of actively jumping between genes and organisms, but they have now been largely inactivated and silenced. Like decommissioned traveling salesmen, these pieces are permanently tethered to our genome, unable to move or get out. These fragments are vastly more common than genes, resulting in yet another major idiosyncrasy of our genome. Much of the human genome is not particularly human. 12. It has replaced elements that appear frequently. A pesky, mysterious 300 base pair sequence called ALU appears and reappears tens of thousands of times, although its origin, function, or significance is unknown. 13. It has enormous gene families, genes that resemble each other and perform similar functions which often cluster together. 200 closely related genes, clustered in archipelagos on certain chromosomes, encode members of the HOX family, many of which play crucial roles in determining the fate, identity, and structure of the embryo, its segments, and its organs. 14. It contains thousands of pseudogenes, genes that were once functional but have become non-functional. That is, they give rise to no protein or RNA. The carcasses of these inactivated genes are littered throughout its length, like fossils decaying on a beach. 15. It accommodates enough variation to make each one of us distinct, yet enough consistency to make each member of our species profoundly different from chimpanzees and bonobos, whose genomes are 96% identical to ours. 16. Its first gene, on chromosome 1, encodes a protein that senses smell in the nose, again, those ubiquitous olfactory genes. Its last gene, on chromosome X, encodes a protein that modulates the interaction between cells of the immune system. The first and last chromosomes are arbitrarily assigned. The first chromosome is labeled first because it is the longest. 17. The ends of its chromosomes are marked with telomeres. Like the little bits of plastic at the ends of shoelaces, these sequences of DNA are designed to protect the chromosomes from fraying and degenerating. 18. Although we fully understand the genetic code, i.e. how the information in a single gene is used to build a protein, we comprehend virtually nothing of the genomic code. That is, how multiple genes spread across the human genome coordinate gene expression in space and time to build, maintain, and repair a human organism. The genetic code is simple. DNA is used to build RNA, and RNA is used to build a protein. A triplet of bases in DNA specifies one amino acid in the protein. The genomic code is complex. Appended to a gene are sequences of DNA that carry information on when and where to express the gene. We do not know why certain genes are located in particular geographic locations in the genome, and how the tracts of DNA that lie between genes regulate and coordinate gene physiology. There are codes beyond codes, like mountains beyond mountains. 19. It imprints and erases chemical marks on itself in response to alterations in its environment, thereby encoding a form of cellular memory. There is more to come on this topic. 20. It is inscrutable, vulnerable, resilient, adaptable, repetitive, and unique. 21. It is poised to evolve. It is littered with the debris of its past. 22. It is designed to survive. 23. It resembles us.
Part 5. Through the Looking Glass. The Genetics of Identity and Normalcy, 2001 to 2015. How nice it would be if we could only get through into Looking Glass House. I'm sure it's got, oh, such beautiful things in it. Lewis Carroll, Alice in Wonderland. So, we's the same. We got to have a revote. This ain't right. Snoop Dogg, on discovering that he has more European ancestry than Charles Barkley. What have I in common with Jews? I have hardly anything in common with myself. Franz Kafka. Medicine, the sociologist Everett Hughes once observed wryly, perceives the world through mirror writing. Illness is used to define wellness. Abnormalcy marks the boundaries of normalcy. Deviance demarcates the limits of conformity. This mirror writing can result in an epically perverse vision of the human body. An orthopedist thus begins to think of bones as sites of fractures. A brain, in a neurologist's imagination, is a place where memories are lost. There is an old story, probably apocryphal, of a Boston surgeon who did lose his memory and could only recall his friends by the names of the various operations he had performed on them. Throughout much of the history of human biology, genes, too, were largely perceived in mirror writing, identified by the abnormality or disease caused when they mutated. Hence the cystic fibrosis gene, the Huntington's gene, the breast cancer-causing BRCA1 gene, and so forth. To a biologist, the nomenclature is absurd. The function of the BRCA1 gene is not to cause breast cancer when mutated, but to repair DNA when normal. The sole function of the benign breast cancer gene BRCA1 is to make sure that DNA is repaired when it is damaged. The hundreds of millions of women without a family history of breast cancer inherit this benign variant of the BRCA1 gene. The mutant variant, or allele, call it mBRCA1, causes a change in the structure of the BRCA1 protein such that it fails to repair damaged DNA. Hence, cancer-causing mutations arise in the genome when BRCA1 malfunctions. The gene called wingless in fruit flies encodes a protein whose real function is not to make wingless insects, but to encode instructions to build wings. Naming a gene cystic fibrosis, or CF, as the science writer Matt Ridley once described it, is as absurd as defining the organs of the body by the diseases they get. Livers are there to cause cirrhosis, hearts to cause heart attacks, and brains to cause strokes. The Human Genome Project allowed geneticists to invert this mirror writing on itself. The comprehensive catalog of every normal gene in the human genome and the tools generated to produce such a catalog made it possible, in principle, to approach genetics from the front side of its mirror. It was no longer necessary to use pathology to define the borders of normal physiology. In 1988, a National Research Council document on the Genome Project made a crucial projection about the future of genomic research. Encoded in the DNA sequence are fundamental determinants of those mental capacities, learning, language, memory, essential to human culture. Encoded there as well are the mutations and variations that cause or increase the susceptibility to many diseases responsible for much human suffering. Vigilant listeners may have noted that the two sentences signaled the twin ambitions of a new science. Traditionally, human genetics had concerned itself largely with pathology, with diseases responsible for much human suffering. But armed with new tools and methods, genetics could also roam freely to explore aspects of human biology that had hitherto seemed impenetrable to it. Genetics had crossed over from the strand of pathology to the strand of normalcy. The new science would be used to understand history, language, memory, culture, sexuality, identity, and race. It would, in its most ambitious fantasies, try to become the science of normalcy, of health, of identity, of destiny. The shift in the trajectory of genetics also signals a shift in the story of the gene. Until this point, the organizing principle of our story has been historical. The journey from the gene to the Genome Project has moved through a relatively linear chronology of conceptual leaps and discoveries. But as human genetics shifted its glance from pathology to normalcy, a strictly chronological approach could no longer capture the diverse dimensions of its inquiry. The discipline shifted to a more thematic focus, organizing itself around distinct, albeit overlapping, arenas of inquiry concerning human biology, the genetics of race, gender, sexuality, intelligence, temperament, and personality. The expanded dominion of the gene would vastly deepen our understanding of the influence of genes on our lives, but the attempt to confront human normalcy through genes would also force the science of genetics to confront some of the most complex scientific and moral conundrums in its history. To understand what genes tell us about human beings, we might begin by trying to decipher what genes tell us about the origins of human beings. In the mid-19th century, before the advent of human genetics, anthropologists, biologists, and linguists fought furiously over the question of human origin. In 1854, a Swiss-born natural historian named Louis Agassiz became the most ardent proponent of a theory called polygenism, which suggested that the three major human races, whites, Asians, and Negroes, as he liked to categorize them, had arisen independently from separate ancestral lineages several million years ago. Agassiz was arguably the most distinguished racist in the history of science, racist both in the original sense of the word, a believer in the inherent differences between human races, and in an operational sense, a believer that some races were fundamentally superior to others. Repulsed by the horror that he might share a common ancestor with Africans, Agassiz maintained that each race had its unique forefather and foremother, and had arisen independently and forked out independently over space and time. The name Adam, he suggested, arose from the Hebrew word for one who blushes, and only a white man could detectably blush. There had to be multiple Adams, Agassiz concluded, blushers and non-blushers, one for each race. In 1859, Agassiz's theory of multiple origins was challenged by the publication of Darwin's Origin of Species. Although Origin pointedly dodged the question of human origin, Darwin's notion of evolution by natural selection was obviously incompatible with Agassiz's separate ancestry of all human races. If finches and tortoises had cascaded out from a common ancestor, why would humans be different? As academic duels go, This one was almost comically one-sided. Agassiz, a grandly bewhiskered Harvard professor, was among the most prominent natural historians of the world, while Darwin, a doubt-ridden, self-taught parson-turned-naturalist from the other Cambridge, was still virtually unknown outside England. Still recognizing a potentially fatal confrontation when he saw one, Agassiz issued a scalding rebuttal to Darwin's book. Had Mr. Darwin or his followers furnished a single fact to show that individuals change in the course of time in such a manner as to produce at last species, the state of the case might be different, he thundered. But even Agassiz had to concede his theory of separate ancestors for separate races ran the risk of being challenged not by a single fact, but a multitude of facts. In 1848, stone diggers in a limestone quarry in the Neander Valley in Germany had accidentally unearthed a peculiar skull that resembled a human skull but also possessed substantial differences, including a larger cranium, a recessed chin, powerfully articulated jawbones, and a pronounced outward jut of the brow. At first, the skull was dismissed as the remnant of a freak that had suffered an accident, a madman stuck in a cave. But over the next decades, a host of similar skulls and bones were disgorged from gorges and caves scattered across Europe and Asia. The bone-by-bone reconstruction of these specimens pointed to a strongly built, prominently browed species that walked upright on somewhat bowed legs, an ornery wrestler with a permanent frown. The hominid was called a Neanderthal after the site of its original location. Initially, many scientists believed that the Neanderthals represented an ancestral form of modern humans, one link in the chain of missing links between humans and apes. In 1922, for instance, an article in Popular Science Monthly called the Neanderthal an early time in the evolution of man. Accompanying the text was a variant of a now familiar image of human evolution, with gibbon-like monkeys transmuting into gorillas, gorillas into upright walking Neanderthals, and so forth, until humans were formed. But by the 1970s and 1980s, the Neanderthal as human ancestor hypothesis had been debunked and replaced by a much stranger idea, that early modern humans coexisted with Neanderthals. The chain of evolution drawings were revised to reflect that gibbons, gorillas, Neanderthals, and modern humans were not progressive stages of human evolution, but had all emerged from a common ancestor. Further anthropological evidence suggested that modern humans, then called Cro-Magnons, had arrived on the Neanderthal scene around 45,000 years ago, most likely by migrating into parts of Europe where Neanderthals lived. We now know that Neanderthals had become extinct 40,000 years ago, having overlapped with early modern humans for about 5,000 years. Cro-Magnons are, indeed, our closer, truer ancestors, possessing the smaller skull, flattened face, receded brow, and thinner jaw of contemporary humans. The politically correct phrase for the anatomically correct Cro-Magnons is European Early Modern Human, or EEMH. These early modern humans intersected with Neanderthals, at least in parts of Europe, and likely competed with them for resources, food, and space. Neanderthals were our neighbors and rivals. Some evidence suggests that we interbred with them and that in competing with them for food and resources, we may have contributed to their extinction. We loved them, and yes, we killed them. But the distinction between Neanderthals and modern humans returns us full circle to our original questions. How old are humans, and where did we come from? In the 1980s, a biochemist at the University of California, Berkeley, named Alan Wilson, began to use genetic tools to answer these questions. Wilson's experiment began with a rather simple idea. Imagine being thrown into a Christmas party. You don't know the host or the guests. 100 men, women, and children are milling around, drinking punch, and suddenly a game begins. You are asked to arrange the crowd by family, relatedness, and descent. You cannot ask for names or ages. You are blindfolded. You are not allowed to construct family trees by looking at facial resemblances or studying mannerisms. To a geneticist, this is a tractable problem. First, he recognizes the existence of hundreds of natural variations, mutations, scattered through each individual genome. The closer the relatedness of individuals, the closer the spectrum of their variants or mutations shared by them.